This is the breakout lunch session, dust up over ditches and other water issues. How many of you have heard of the waters of the U.S.? How many haven't? Let's go that way. All right, get out of here, Chuck. All right, so we don't need to explain that. I mean, I just did a session on dead zone, and I had to ask beforehand, does everybody know what a dead zone is? So fortunately, everybody did. So anyway, we're privileged to have with us today Ellen Galinsky, Senior Policy Advisor to the EPA's Office of Water, who's here to put to rest all those awful myths about the Waters of the U.S. rule and to share with us the secret maps showing where all these ditches are that they're going to require permits from. Ellen, why don't you start by telling us a little bit about why you're, how did we get here? Why is this regulation being proposed?
Okay.
All right.
May I? All right. Well, while you all finish eating lunch, I'm going to give you sort of a 10-minute quick summary of what we're doing and why we're doing it, and then open it up to your questions. I'm very excited to be here. Really appreciate the opportunity to talk to all of you who I know are very well informed about a lot of environmental issues, and apparently Waters of the U.S. has occupied the news waves for the last 6 months to a year. So what are we doing? What was wrong with the definition of waters of the U.S. under the Clean Water Act? Been around since the 70s. What are we doing now? So the bottom line is that right now, not all of our waters are protected. The Clean Water Act was enacted to protect the physical, chemical, and biological integrity of the nation's waters. And that's just not happening completely now, because what constitutes the nation's waters, it has been up for debate. And it's been debated a lot in the courts, and no offense to any lawyers in here, I know there's at least one Pat. Having to decide in a court of law what water is protected to keep clean and safe water for us to live and recreate and drink and et cetera, that's not the way to do it. So there have been all kinds of court cases looking at, well, this isn't a waters of the U.S. and you can't regulate it, and so somebody can pollute it. It's been into the Supreme Court three times, and with differing decisions each time. And the final time in Rapanos, there wasn't really even a decision. It was a split decision. And as part of that split decision, the Supreme Court said, agencies, would you just clarify once and for all what constitutes waters of the U.S.? Make it clear what constitutes a significant nexus, what constitutes a tributary system. These things were not defined. The word tributary was not even defined in Waters of the U.S., yet Waters of the U.S. says tributaries to traditional navigable waters are covered, but then you don't define tributaries. So that's really what we're about. We're about clarity and certainty as to what waters are protected. And why is this important? It's because we are seeing threats to the nation's clean waters. One in three Americans get drinking water from streams, from seasonally flowing streams, and those are the ones that are at most jeopardy under the current law, because the word tributary is poorly defined about how high up it goes in the headwaters. These headwater streams are where we get a lot of our drinking water from. We had a science study done referred to as the connectivity study that's currently under review by our scientific advisory board. But this study, it wasn't like new research. It was a compilation of years and years of research on stream networks that show how downstream waters are very much affected by what goes on in the upstream waters. And I'm going to use my favorite analogy that I stole from Bern Sweeney at Stroud Water Research Lab about the circulatory system. So it's like these seasonal waters and headwaters are like the capillaries that then flow to the veins and the arteries in your blood system. You cut off the capillaries, you know, what happens to the rest of your circulatory system? So you've got to have the whole picture. So what we've looked at what the science says, and the science says that you have a tributary network from seasonally flowing streams down to year-round flowing streams, down to your traditionally navigable waters, which are, you know, the ones that you can put a boat on, like the Mississippi River out here, and then, you know, down to the coastal waters. And those are all waters of the U.S. And that is really what the Clean Water Act contemplated. The Clean Water Act did not just cover navigable, in fact, waters. It covered tributaries of navigable, in fact, waters. It just didn't define them. So that's something that, you know, one of the myths that's been around is that, you know, the Clean Water Act was just meant to cover waters you can float a boat in. That's not what it says. And I'll refer you to the professor over there if you have any questions about that. So that is really the we're using science to tell us these streams and the wetlands that are associated with these streams that they are important. So we cover the tributary system, we cover adjacent waters. Again, the original definition talked about wetlands next to all of the above waters, including tributaries. But it didn't define what next to was. You know, what's adjacent? Is it 100 miles away? Is it, you know, right next to it? So what we've done in the proposal is say that adjacent means within the floodplain of these tributaries, or within the river buffer, the riparian buffer, along these rivers and streams and, you know, headwaters, so that waters within those areas are covered under the Clean Water Act. We did not say that the floodplain itself or the riparian buffer itself is now a waters of the U.S. That's another confusion area that we've heard about. So that's a very important thing. We define neighboring as, the word neighboring is what's used to define adjacent, but neighboring was never defined. So we define neighboring as within a floodplain or riparian buffer. So waters within those areas are also, would be considered in. These, and the waters I'm talking about would not need a case-by-case determination, which is what happens now. So for areas that are in dispute, the Corps comes out and there's a lengthy study, and sometimes it goes to the courts, and maybe 3 years later you'll know if these waters are protected. And meanwhile, this is your drinking water source. I mean, it's just not an effective way to do business. Then there's a third category of waters, other waters. And those are waters that you've probably heard about, the prairie potholes, the playa lakes, things like that, that are further away from the main network, the circulatory network. And we looked at the science, and there was, while certain of these other waters, it's been shown how they are connected physically, chemically, biologically, some aren't, and it there was not an overwhelming evidence one way or the other to say they're all in or they're all out. So we still left those waters as a case by case. You have to determine significant nexus or how they contribute to the system, because we just didn't feel the science was there. Maybe at some later date after researchers look at that, we'll know a little bit more about that. So that's really what the proposal is. It does not change the exemptions from the Clean Water Act permits at all. It doesn't change the exclusions. So, you know, if you didn't need a permit before to do to pollute waters of the U.S., you don't need it now. Agriculture is still exempt from, you know, having to get permits for most everything, not some. Under Section 402 of the Clean Water Act, they still would need a permit if they're going to, you know, put pesticides in a water or fertilizer directly in a water. exemptions are still there for maintenance of ditches. That's been an issue for localities as well as farmers. You know, they can still maintain their drainage ditches. That's a permit exclusion. So none of that was changed. The whole concept of who needs a permit was not changed. It's just what constitutes a waters of the U.S. And people are behind this. I mean, who doesn't want clean water? If you ask somebody, do you want clean water for your farm, for your business? People want clean water. There was a recent survey, 80% of U.S. small business owners favor including small streams and headwaters in Clean Water Act protections because these businesses depend on clean water for their operation. We depend on clean water for drinking. Farmers depend on clean water to irrigate their crops. And this is what it's about. It's about protecting upstream waters from people who are going to pollute. And they would need to get a permit with conditions in it if they're going to fill or pollute these waters. So that's really what it's about. You know, the whole proposal is really four pages. There's, you know, a 200-page preamble that explains everything, but it's pretty simple. It's pretty surgical fix to what was confused before.
All right. Thank you, Alan. I guess the question I have here still is, so what difference does it make? When, you know, we were just talking before, my first exposure to this was last spring when I was invited by some environmental groups in Baltimore to come to a press conference out at the on the harbor, which I think there was no question that was a water of the U.S., to talk about this rule, and Nancy Stoner, who was then acting as Assistant Administrator for Water, came. And the environmentalists were very excited because they felt that now, finally, many waterways in Maryland and across the country that had previously not been protected were now going to be protected. And yet when I asked others, officials, what does this do, I was told, well, it really doesn't change anything. So what difference does it make?
Well, it does make a difference. We are not protecting any new kinds of water. So, you know, it's not like all of a sudden a certain water body that we didn't protect, like somebody's ornamental pond in their backyard, is protected now. That's another thing we've been told that this protects, as well as rooftop gardens are now going to be waters of the U.S., green roofs, you name it. So we're not protecting any of those. It doesn't protect new kinds of waters, but it provides a clear protection for them everywhere. What's happened is in certain parts of the United States, it's been more problematic than others because the Clean Water Act is administered by the core districts, Corps of Engineers. There's many core districts, and there's been different court cases in different areas of the country that have led certain types of waters to be more susceptible. So, you know, isolated waters, which under some court cases, were actually waters that were within a floodplain, which could be considered neighboring. But in certain areas like Maryland, Virginia, Pennsylvania, they already have state laws that cover these waters, so there's not a big difference in those states. But in some states, there's it's two-thirds of the states rely on the federal definition of waters of the United States for their own state waters. So for the third of states that have their own definition of state waters, you're not going to see a big difference because permits are required by the state regardless.
Will EPA have some oversight authority over how the states enforce that now?
Well, not if it's a water that is not a federal water. So for instance, I'm going to use Virginia as an example because I was the water director in Virginia. And we had our own wetlands program, so we required permits for all wetlands, and our definition of waters was all water on the surface and in the ground. That's pretty a comprehensive. So we would issue some state permits in addition to a federal 404 permit for those isolated waters, and the federal government did not have oversight over those.
What about the the headwater streams, the so-called intermittent streams that are wet only at certain times of the year? These are the ones I was told were sort of at issue here.
Yes, they are really important, and that's what the science has shown us, is that this is where nutrients are broken down and enter the system that then the fish feed on. So if you are filling those headwater streams or polluting those headwater streams, it gets downstream. If you fill them, you're eliminating that initial source of food for the downstream organisms, like the fish that everybody depends on to eat, to recreate in. They are vulnerable, and those are the areas that are vulnerable to development, too. That's where you're getting the shopping centers and things like that being developed. So we're not saying that they can't be developed. It's just we need to look at that through a permitting mechanism, and you need to replace the lost functions after you've minimized your impacts.
But some of those, maybe many, are either not regulated or inconsistently regulated.
Yes,
now.
Correct.
Right. So because a developer will come in and say it's dry 9 months of the year, state regulator says, okay, it's not really a waterway, right?
Well, no, that would be the federal regulation.
I mean,
so
the way it's worked in some states now.
Well, the Corps needs, right now, the Corps would have to do a significant nexus test. So they would have to look at a waterway that doesn't flow year-round, and they'd have to judge what is the significant connection to downstream, and they'd have to do, paperwork on it.
So how many?
And that doesn't happen everywhere.
How many miles or acres of waters that previously were not covered with this cover?
Okay, so I don't know how many acres or miles, but what the Corps estimated, because I don't have the maps, but what the Corps estimated, they went and looked at the jurisdictional determinations they had made over the past several years and which ones were determined that they couldn't decide because they needed more information, whatever. And they figured that there would be a 3% change in jurisdiction. So there would be a 3% increase in the waters they would call jurisdictional because they would be defined in the rule rather than having to go out in the field. Now, that's not spread evenly over the country. So likely in the arid West, where calls on headwater streams were a little more difficult, they'll probably see a bigger increase versus in the mid-Atlantic, there'll probably be no change because it was a lot easier to make the calls.
Okay. So if this is such a good thing, why is it that EPA is getting such a hard time?
And I'm going to ask all of you that. Let me talk about these maps. Since you're so intent on having me talk about these maps, Travis, get the maps out. Okay, so if you're, of course, now I'm gonna sound like a really old person. So before I go on a trip, I take out an actual map. The rest of you probably use Google Maps, whatever. But I take out my AAA map, and I look at it, and I look at where the roads are, and is one of these roads a dotted line that's a dirt road or whatever, and I plan my trip. So scientists always use maps. Regulators use maps. They use a map to look at it before they go out to a site to say, what am I going to see there? Now, just because it's on a map doesn't mean you're going to see it. For years, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has published national wetland inventory maps, and those are developed from pretty sophisticated aerial photographs, infrared, whatever, and they map where wetlands are and wetlands by type. And they publish those. You can buy them. They're online now. So, but that doesn't necessarily tell you, do you have a wetland on your property? Because they're only as accurate as the mapping is and the scale of the map. But, before you go out to do a wetland determination on a property, most consultants and regulators look at the National Wetland Inventory map to see, does this map say I'm going to see something? Then they also look at a USGS map a topographic map, which I know you're all familiar with, to see are there any blue line streams. Those are free-flowing streams year-round. Are dotted line streams are the intermittent streams. That doesn't mean they're going to be free-flowing or intermittent when you get to that property, because those maps were made years ago and conditions in the watershed have changed. So these maps, what EPA did in, I think, 2005, we had a consultant take these different sources of maps and sort of combine them onto, I think it's called an NHD basis. I don't even know what that means, National Hydrologic Data. And to develop, you know, some maps on the computer so you could see for a given area, are there a lot of intermittent streams there? Are there a lot of whatever? So now what we're hearing is that we develop these maps so we would know how many ditches would be regulated or how many we'd be able to track it down to a person's property. And that's just ridiculous. They're very gross scale. It's like a highway map with roads. If you look at that, you're not going to be able to tell, does that road go next to your house?
So how would you go about determining whether you need to have a permit to go forward?
Okay, you have to go out in the field. So the Corps of Engineers has, under a memorandum of agreement between the Corps and EPA, who jointly administer Section 404 of the Clean Water Act. There's other, all the sections of the Clean Water Act depend on this definition, but 404 is the one you hear about the most, because that's dredging and filling. So they have, you have to go out on the site and look at the wetlands and streams on the site, and then they make a jurisdictional determination, which is a legal document that says, here are these areas on your site. Now, whether or not you need a permit to do anything with those waters is a different matter because of all the exemptions and exclusions.
Okay. All right. Well, so let's throw it up into questions. This is a, you know, general Q&A. There's some certain ground rules. The general SEJ ground rules apply. We're asking questions, not making speeches. That doesn't mean you can't set up your question, but let's make it brief. And please identify yourself. And priority for questioning goes to SEJ members and working journalists, whether you're an SEJ member or not. But please identify yourself and your affiliation before you ask your question. And the last ground rule for this lunch, a somewhat flexible one, is that we're here, Ellen has agreed to be here to answer your questions about any water-related topic. But let's take the questions on waters of the U.S. first.
Travis agreed for me.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, so she can get beat up on Travis later if we veer from that. But we will start with the waters of the U.S., exhaust your fascination with that, and then any other questions you have as time permits. And we have about 40 minutes here. Okay. I'll play the microphone game, and you got that, all right?
Tom Henry at the Toledo Blade. I covered the story quite a lot when the arguments went to the Supreme Court. I interviewed Rapanos, and I interviewed his attorney, who came to the University of Toledo's College of Law and just gave a rousing speech about how he felt he successfully was crusading for private property rights. And, you know, as you know, they're funded by the Mackinac Center, which is very into the private property rights issue. My point, kind of following on what Tim was asking, there's a lot at stake here. There's, you know, not just thousands, potentially millions of dollars that are going into this. How do we sort out who the winners and losers are? What is, you know, what's going to be better defined? And Rapanos, essentially, if I remember right, goes back to selling your property so it can be, you know, redeveloped into a strip mall, mm-hmm. or whatnot. With the growth and the suburbanization that's going on, how is this going to be applied to urban sprawl?
Okay. Well, the winners are the American public. It's the people who depend on clean and safe water to drink, to recreate in, to do their businesses. This proposal just clarifies what waters are waters of the U.S. It doesn't change any of the permitting requirements. So you can get a permit to build a shopping center. You just have to avoid, minimize, and then mitigate for the wetlands, that you disturb. I was a... I've done many things in my previous life. So I was a wetlands consultant for 12 years, and I got tons of permits for developers without any problem whatsoever because they, you know, they just wanted to build their project, and they were willing to do what they needed to do to get a permit. I mean, they're used to getting permits. And, you know, again, something that we say is the... in terms of property rights, the only reason you need to be concerned if you have waters of the U.S. on your property is if you're going to pollute them. Because just the mere fact that you have them on your property does not, you know, mean anything one way or the other. But if you want, if you're going to pollute them, fill them, dredge them, then you need a permit. And very few people have been denied permits unless it's an unreasonable project. And I think, you know, Pat, you could, what, like three?
9% of the 404 permits are granted. What's the issue?
Yeah. And these are permits for big projects. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, but it still seems like it's almost intentionally vague, and I'm not sure in terms of, you know, trying to define how we're moving forward, and it seems like there's a lot of litigation going into this, and not a lot of clarity in terms of how we move forward with this.
Okay, well, the proposal is just about the definition of waters of the U.S. The everything that surrounds, you know, who needs a permit and how you get a permit and how you do a jurisdictional determination, that's not in the Clean Water Act. Those are in, you know, guidance and field manuals and things that the agencies have to go about their business. So that's really where, you know, where you find out, you know, what you need to do. By providing a clearer definition, we have let people know that if you have a tributary, then that is a waters of the U.S. Right now, they don't have that clarity because tributary is not defined. It just says the word tributary. So it's all by just practice and things that aren't in the law. This would say in the law that a tributary, it has a defined bed and bank and ordinary high water mark and can extend from seasonal waters, you know, down to traditionally navigable waters.
Just real quick, too.
You got your follow-up.
Real quick.
All right.
Is this a binding definition,
or is this a proposal that's going to be litigated? And also, what do you do for people? You know, you just said if you intend to pollute waters, but what do you say you didn't intend to, and it's an incidental?
Okay, well, that's in implementation of the proposal, and that's just, you know, that's enforcement and other areas that are not going to change from this. Yes, this is a proposal, but when it becomes final, yes, this will be the definition of waters of the U.S.
You want to ask a question? Hi, I'm Nina Satija from the Texas Tribune. I think what Tom was saying about vagueness is sort of that we are all having trouble understanding what this really means. So for the state that I work in, like Texas, how can I try and understand... Well, you know, if we can talk about a particular tributary, and that's covered and before it wasn't, obviously, you know, in Texas, we are a part of the arid west, at least half of the state is, so I would think there would be areas that would be impacted, but we just, coming up with examples to explain this to readers has been basically, you know, impossible. So where do I go, you know,
okay,
where do I go to kind of understand that?
Well, again, if you go to the definition of tributary, it's a water conveyance that has a defined bed and bank, so a channel, and an ordinary high water mark, which might not be so easy to explain. But you can look on our website, on the EPA website. What is the website address? EPA.gov/USWaters. We have all kinds of references on there and explanations. In terms of effects in a local area, the best place to go is to your state water quality agency. Might be able to tell you about that. But you know, we can't really answer specific questions about is this particular, was it covered before, was it covered now? Those are the kind of things that you got to go out in the field and look at.
So when you say you have to go out in the field, who is going to do that? I mean, is the Army Corps going to go throughout the U.S. and do this, or how
is
that?
Okay. So, again, going back to my statement that the only time that it really becomes relevant that you have a Waters of the U.S. on your property is if you intend to pollute. So what you do is, if you intend to do a project that's going to dredge, fill, or, you know, put a pipe, you know, an industry putting a pipe into a water, then you get a jurisdictional determination from the local Corps of Engineers office. Yes. Yes, we're not doing maps of the entire United States, going out and mapping jurisdiction, because, you know, that's impractical. It's you know, it just wouldn't be possible to get people out to every place, and there's no need to do it.
Lana Straub, I'm a freelancer with West Texas Public Radio. Living in West Texas around the oil boom, I'm just curious how this is going to affect the spill prevention and control measures plans, and people who have those plans, and how they're going to have to modify them and that kind of stuff.
Well, we have been reaching out to the oil and gas industry about you know, impacts to them about the rule. They've been concerned about you know, their pad sites and things like that. Especially with regard to this other waters category, because that's not so clear. Where a tributary is pretty clear, but, you know, an isolated water might not be. And we're accepting comments. The comment period, by the way, is open until October 20th. And we've gotten many comments on how we could further clarify things. But, again, you can get a permit. And they are used to getting permits, because they have to get permits now, certainly if they're going to discharge any oil and gas fluids into a surface water, which they don't really do so much anymore. But that requires a Section 402 of the Clean Water Act permit. And just to clarify, it just reminded me, so the Clean Water Act does not cover groundwater. The Safe Drinking Water Act has some groundwater provisions, but the Clean Water Act does not regulate groundwater, so discharges to groundwater would not be an issue with this.
When in doubt, get a permit.
Well, ask. When in doubt, ask.
Hi, Peter Fairley. I'm a freelance journalist based in British Columbia. It seemed when you gave your intro that I think you thought you were providing basic clarity by saying it's anything within the floodplain or the riparian zone,
but not anything. Well, waters.
That's the question: is what is waters? I think maybe you didn't go far enough in just explaining the basic science.
Okay.
And you mentioned anything that has a defined bed and bank. Is that the idea that you're saying? Basically, if it leaves a continuous trace, then it is, and it is ultimately connected to an obvious body, then it is a stream, then it is a
tributary,
a water.
Yes. So let me, good question, so I'll go over this again. So waters of the U.S. include, we're looking at basically streams, rivers, and wetlands. So a wetland has a specific definition. So a wetland is an area that has hydric soils, so water-loving soils, which are identified by their color and other attributes. Hydrophytic vegetation, which is water-loving vegetation, so it has to have a prevalence of that. And again, there's manuals you go through, you look at the vegetation. And then it has to have water within 12 inches of the surface for, I think, 30% of the growing season, and the growing season differs in all around the country. So again, that's what determines a wetland that is would be covered under the Clean Water Act. So that's pretty distinctive. And the tributaries have to have, it's water that flows in a, you know, in a pattern from headwaters down to, you know, the mouths of rivers, and but it, it has to flow in a defined channel, so that water that is just diffuse, you know, like in a floodplain, you have water that can be just diffuse and it, you know, soaks into the groundwater. That's what a floodplain does. That's not a waters of the U.S. But if there's a stream channel, if there's an actual channel with bed and bank within the floodplain, that would be a waters of the U.S. Or if there's a pond area.
So is that what's new here?
It's not new, but it's defined so that it's you don't have to do it on a case-by-case situation that then is, you know, litigated in court each time if somebody doesn't like what the Corps said. It would mean that those areas are in, everybody would know they're in. Again, remember, tributary was already in the definition of waters of the U.S., but it wasn't defined itself. So what we've done is we've defined what tributary is. Is that, hopefully that's clear.
Have we exhausted waters of the U.S. already? Oh, you again.
Sorry.
All right, well, I want to ask one question. I'm executing my privilege for a moment. So you say developers, of course, you know, are used to getting permits and there's no big deal with this. My impression is that the home builders aren't very happy with this, right? Nor are the oil and gas industry. In addition to the farmers are really torqued out about it, but so why are they so upset if this is no big deal?
Well, of course, I cannot put myself in their shoes, so I don't know why they're so upset. But I will say we've been doing a lot of outreach on this, and we've been talking to farmers, we've been talking to the development community. You know, people have submitted comments. I can't tell you why they're upset about it or not. I think there is a lot of misinformation about the rule, and I think that, you know, truly some farmers who I've talked to, you know, I've been out on their farms looking at their ditches and things like that, and I'm like, what are you worried about? And they're like, oh my God, we're going to have a permit for everything we do. Well, that's not what the proposal says. And in fact, the proposal specifically excludes certain types of ditches that were not specifically excluded before. So actually, less ditches are covered under this rule than currently, which is something that farmers don't know. And the reason they don't know is because they don't need a permit. Again, it goes back to the fact that if you don't need a permit to pollute, then this is like a non-issue for you. So they weren't aware those ditches were jurisdictional before. So we've specifically excluded ditches that are in upland, that had been created through uplands, which a lot of farm ditches are, and that flow less than year-round. That eliminates a lot of ditches, a lot of roadside ditches and a lot of farm field ditches. But the point is that they don't need a permit anyhow. I mean, this one farmer actually told me, he said, oh my God, I'm going to have to get a permit to plow my field. I'm like, no, you don't. And he said, well, my field's in a floodplain. And I said, well, first of all, floodplain's not a jurisdictional water. And second of all, normal farming practices are exempt from permitting. So just a lot of misunderstanding out there. And actually, the home builders have had very specific questions, but I don't feel like they've been overall, I haven't seen a big campaign against the rule. There is a big campaign in the farming community.
Only because you raised the phrase ordinary high water mark, one of my favorite phrases. And you can either consider this related to Rapanos or a segue to other miscellaneous water issues, but is there anything coming out of Rapanos that might affect the beach walker cases? In Ohio, it's been a major controversy all across the Great Lakes region because the states have a mishmash of rules, and many go back to the ordinary high water mark, the historic high water mark, and other things, where waterfront property owners are claiming that people are trespassing on their property for beach access. And generally, people are told if you keep your ankles wet and stay in the water, you can't be accused of that. But still, the Ohio Lakefront Group and others have really taken this, you know, to the level of being frankly very bitchy about, you know, anyone who crosses their property on an ordinary or historic high watermark. And I'm just wondering, since you're the definition that you're working on here, could it be applied to other cases like beach access cases across the Great Lakes?
Okay, good question. So this does not affect state laws that talk about property rights and that. I mean, every state has their own law about King's Grant and who owns the stream bottom and all that stuff. So the short answer is no. And actually, we do not define ordinary high watermark in the proposal, and that's something we've received a lot of comments on, that we should define it. And, you know, obviously we're going to consider that seriously. We just figured it was a term of art that, you know, practitioners would know, but it can be defined differently. But nothing in this proposal interferes with states' rights in terms of property access or water rights is another big issue, of course, in the West. And this doesn't speak to that at all.
Ours, just so you know, ours is going back to English common law of the 1500s or something like that.
So.
Other question?
May I change topics to another?
Yes, all right.
Is that okay now?
Sure.
Okay.
I'll try.
My name is Cynthia Barnett. I'm an independent journalist covering water, and I'm based in Florida. And my question is about the quality of drinking water. Many of our members over the past year or so, Tom has covered the Toledo drinking water crisis, and others have covered the story in Charleston, West Virginia. Mm-hmm. And my question involves federal funding. In the old days, we used to see a lot of subsidies for drinking water infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Then over time, the idea was to transfer over to grants and to help communities and citizens pay for their own, you know, pay the full value for water. But those two cases seem to show that agricultural industry, chemical industry, that some of the polluters sort of get off the hook for paying for those problems. Now, Toledo, for example, faces a possibly $1 billion price tag for its new drinking water plant. So could you talk about that sort of large philosophy of how communities can pay for some of these problems that are becoming more universal because of the pollution and climate change, and whether it's right for ratepayers to foot the bill for all of this? Sorry for the length
of
that question.
Well, I'm not going to comment on whether it's right for ratepayers to foot the bill, but I will tell you about what we're doing. So we are doing a lot about the safety of drinking water. I mean, that's of primary importance in the Office of Water and under the Safe Drinking Water Act. So there are, there's the Drinking Water SRF, the State Revolving Fund, where the feds, EPA, has dollars that we then give to states on a special allocation formula, and then they, in turn, have certain rules where they give that out to localities to upgrade their drinking water facilities. Now, currently, there is, you referred to, you know, are we giving the money, are we loaning the money? So in the drinking water SRF, we're doing both. So there's a principal subsidization, and I can't remember the percentage. I want to say 20%, but that might not be correct, where you can give the money, and then the rest is low-interest loans. So that's geared at, you know, having facilities upgrade to the best kind of water treatment possible. There's also a USDA, through their rural development program, works specifically with small communities to give money to them, because a lot of them don't even have drinking water treatment. So there are plenty of people in the United States who drink untreated water, and that really shouldn't be. So that's really you know, what we're trying to do. The other thing that we're doing is in the Toledo instance, Toledo's an example of this. You've got to have source water protection, because a treatment system can't take care of everything that comes into it. So you've got to keep the pollutants out of the water. And again, this is where the Waters of the U.S. rule comes in, to have rules about polluting headwater streams. But also, we work with Source Water Protection. There's a Source Water Collaborative, which is a variety of organizations, nonprofits, as well as federal agencies that work to do source water protection plans, which again, would have been helpful to have an updated one with the West Virginia situation, where that would have identified, that facility actually was identified in West Virginia's source water protection plan. So those are the kind of things we can do to prevent. But, you know, it's really working with states and localities, not taking federal responsibility for it, but helping them. Sorry for the long-winded answer.
I'm Bruce Ritchie. I'm a reporter from Tallahassee, Florida, FloridaEnvironments.com. In some of the interstate water disputes we see emerging, you've got Corps of Engineers projects, dams and reservoirs. You have a Federal Endangered Species Act with the Fish and Wildlife Service raising flags. Mm-hmm. But what is the EPA's role, and how could the federal role, how is it evolving, if any, in this in resolving these kinds of disputes, especially as far as the health of overall river and estuary ecosystems?
Okay, well, the EPA has no role in water allocation. So the situations you refer to, I know the Corps of Engineers is involved because they have they've engineered the whole water supply in Georgia and Florida and such. So, I mean, they control the flow of water. Water allocation is the state's prerogative, and EPA does not have a role in that. In terms of making sure the water is of high quality or trying to help with that, we do. And we do get involved in issues of flow as they affect water quality, because if you cut off if you have low flow situations, then you're concentrating pollutants and you could not be meeting standards. So we do look at flow issues, and we've worked with some states who want to establish flow standards for certain bodies of waters, that the flow has to be, a minimum. But again, that's a state, that would be a state rule to pass, not the federal government. I don't know, but we do not have a direct role.
Ellen, could I just interject? Would you like to say something about the transfer rule and the connection to the Waters of the U.S. rule?
I would not.
You don't want to do that?
Because we're... Yeah, you okay. May...
So, Bruce, one thing, Pat Parento, Vermont Law School, troublemaker. One thing, Bruce, you want to keep an eye on is EPA, it was actually the Bush administration that adopted it, but the Obama administration has continued it, created a rule known as the Water Transfer Rule, which exempts the transfer of water from one basin to another, even if the water being transferred is totally polluted, even if it's toxic. If it's a transfer from one water body to another water body and the transfer mechanism doesn't add anything to the transfer, it's exempt from the Clean Water Act. Okay? The district court in New York has struck the rule down and has said, I don't understand how you can exempt water being transferred from one basin to another at the same time you're writing a rule, the Waters of the U.S. rule, that's connecting all the waters. Got it? So the court says, I don't understand what you're doing, EPA. Go back and try again. The 11th Circuit, in your neck of the woods, upheld the water transfer rule in the Okeechobee back pumping case. Okay, so we've got a split in the courts. This one is tailor-made for the United States Supreme Court at some point, but it does have dramatic effects on the way water is going to be moved around this country going forward in a climate-altered world. So there definitely is a connection here.
Somebody hasn't asked a question yet.
Randy Schofield with Trout Unlimited. We work a lot with ranchers and farmers. Oh, I thought about every year.
Yep. Is there a journalist who hasn't got a question asked yet?
They're never done asking questions.
There we go. Yep, that's right. Now, freelancers are journalists. Yes, we recognize them. I've been a freelancer myself.
Good afternoon. I'm Chuck Quirnbach of Wisconsin Public Radio in Milwaukee. Could you talk a little bit about the 404C doings at Pebble Mine, Alaska, and also, as you know, perhaps, some northern Wisconsin Native American tribes would like similar application to a Pinoki Hills mine. Maybe if you can speak at least generally about EPA's use of 404C.
Well, our use of 404C, I'm in general familiar with it, but not the details of it. And I'm certainly not an attorney, so I can't. But 404C exists to do vetoes of permits that were issued by the Corps for dredger fill. And that's when EPA has used it only very infrequently. We have issued proposals to do a 404C because it has to go through a public comment process, but have only done it rarely. But it's where EPA, who, again, we jointly administer the program with the Corps of Engineers 404, where EPA feels like there's more than a minimal impact to the resource. So, we use it sparingly, but when we feel it's needed, and again, it has to go through a very public process.
Okay. Other journalists, questions? Here? Right. And okay. All right.
Okay. So I'm going to take us back. Rachel Evan with Bloomberg BNA. I'm going to take us back to water quality trading. I was wondering if the very nature of water quality trading prohibits regional trading across larger watersheds, like the Mississippi River Basin, and why would that be the case if it is?
Okay, so no, there. The concept of water quality trading is not limited, at least EPA doesn't limit it, to be within a larger watershed. I will tell you that states themselves often limit that. I know when I was in Virginia, it was like, well, we're not trading with another state. We want to, we're going to take care of our own water quality. We're not going to, trade between states. But there are certain, so under the Clean Water Act, you can't violate water quality standards. You can't, create a toxic area, those kind of things. So that sort of limits the extent of trading. I mean, you can't trade in different basins, for instance, because you're not getting the water quality improvements within a basin. But like the Ohio River trading plan, which EPA endorsed, is, I think, four states along the Ohio River for very large stretches. And like I said, the rules just, have in them that you can't create what are called hot spots where you violate water quality standards. So, no, there is not a limit to that. The limit is more, states and their, and localities and their willingness to go outside of their state or locality to trade.
I'm Glenda Booth. I'm a freelancer based in Northern Virginia, D.C. area. A lot of the older urban communities still have combined sewer overflow systems. And it appears that in some of the states, like Virginia, the state permitting agency just continues to renew their permits year after year. So is there anything at the federal level that's pushing these areas to upgrade mm-hmm. their combined sewer mm-hmm. overflow systems?
Yes, there are. The Clean Water Act itself is pushing the upgrades. And actually, in Virginia, there's only three combined sewer overflow areas: Northern Virginia, the Alexandria, Richmond, and Lynchburg. And those are all under consent orders with the state, and they have long-term control plans. I do happen to know that, again, from my past experience. But when I say long-term control plans, I mean long-term, okay?
Very long.
like 50 years or so. And that's because where you have, yeah, where you have aging infrastructure, it's very hard to do these improvements. What we're looking at now, but so there is a requirement to fix the combined sewer overflows all over the country. And it's worked into permits and consent orders. But what we're trying to do now, and that has been successfully done in Philadelphia, in Baltimore, in New York City, those consent decrees, which EPA is a party to, but it's done by the state, they've been renegotiated to include green infrastructure practices because those are more cost-effective and they have multiple benefits, and to try to look at getting those in now while they're digging the tunnels. You know, in Washington, D.C., they've got this huge tunnel project in Rock Creek Park that, you know, is going to take forever and billions of dollars. So in the meantime, they're looking at controlling sources of stormwater by putting in green infrastructure within the park. So I really commend you to Philadelphia, Baltimore, and New York City as examples where we've looked at the CSO plan and reinvigorated it at the request of the permittee themselves. Well, it's under the Clean Water Act. I mean, they have a permit, a 402 permit, and it's in their 402 permit.
I don't know whether you're the right person to ask about this, and maybe somebody else in the room knows the answer, but is there an... Oh, sorry. Veronique LaCapra, St. Louis Public Radio. Does the EPA regulate private drinking water wells? And if not, who does? Is it at the federal level? Is it at the state level? Both regulates in terms of water quality and also just tracks the existence of them.
Yeah. EPA does not. So I'm assuming that might be at the local level. I don't think states necessarily regulate private wells either.
Any others? Okay. Journalist? Yeah. Yes? Okay. We still got 7 minutes.
That's all. Hi there. Robin Bravender with Greenwire. Robin Bravender with Greenwire. Just curious, you haven't had a confirmed administrator in your office for several years now. I just wondered if you could talk about whether that impacts your work, this rule, or anything else you're doing over there.
You are correct that Ken Kaposis has been the nominee, the president's nominee for assistant administrator for water for over 3 years now and has not been confirmed. Nancy Stoner was recently the acting assistant administrator, and she has left the agency. And actually, we cannot have an acting assistant administrator any longer due to some various laws. Ken Kaposis is heading up the office now as the deputy administrator. And no, we life goes on, and we're doing the work, the same work we'd be doing, and under the direction of Gina McCarthy, the EPA administrator, who's the ultimate decision maker anyhow. No. And in fact, the administrator has made the commitment that we will publish a final rule on Waters of the U.S.
All right. One more back here. And then we'll get to you. All right. I promise. You get the second to last question.
Thank you. Nina from the Tribune, the Texas Tribune. To go back to the Waters of the U.S. thing briefly, so I guess as far as I understand, it's not a question of the EPA coming to someone's house and saying, you know, you're now home to the waters of the U.S., but it's on the own, which is normal. And I guess this is how environmental law generally works. It's the person who may need the permit that needs to initiate that process. So in that case, then, is this more about, I mean, you know, from an enforcement standpoint, that if the EPA did find something wrong, you could then go and say, You are liable. You should have asked for a permit, and you should have known that you were, you know, you had waters of the U.S. Because otherwise there's no hammer, right? There's no new permitting mechanism that's being created here.
Well, enforcement would work as it does today. If and it's really the Corps of Engineers again who they initiate any enforcement actions, and then EPA or the state may join in depending on. You know, the situation. But it's the same as today. If someone is filling a wetland and a neighbor calls in and calls the Corps and says, does this person have a permit? And the Corps either says, yes, they do, or they're like, oh, thanks, we'll come out and look at it. And, you know, so it's all about reporting. It's not, no one's going out scouring the countryside to find these things, to be honest.
Okay, well, that's a good segue. I'm going to ask one quick question, then we're going back here for the, maybe for the last question. We'll see. On that point, I had remembered seeing this. I couldn't find it because my internet wasn't working over there. But Grant Nakayama?
Yes.
Yep. Wrote a memo that said that between July 20, 2006 and March 2008, the agency had decided not to pursue formal enforcement in 304 cases in... Was that nationally or regionally? Because of
nationally. It was the national enforcement
because of jurisdictional uncertainty. So, I mean, this is where the rubber meets the road on this thing, is it not? Somebody complains, or you find out about a case where somebody did not get a permit, and you go in and you suddenly you're in a squabble, and because you're uncertain, you back down. And if this is changed, then you actually have the grounds to make these people get permits and mitigate or compensate for what they've done.
That is correct. And actually, though, the cases he was referring to, a lot of them had to do with oil spills. It wasn't necessarily dredging or filling, but it was where, you know, or midnight dumping, you know, where you get someone who's got a septic tank they're supposed to empty and they don't quite make it to the license place. They're supposed to empty it out. So they, you know, that's what midnight dumping is called. They go and, you know, pump it out in a... What they think is, oh, this is just a ditch, but it's the waters of the U.S. So that particular memo, Grant, I can't pronounce his name, but anyhow, I didn't work at EPA then, but he was the enforcement director. And so, yes, there were a lot of cases like that, but mainly they really had to do with oil spills and illegal dumping.
Okay. All right.
As you had mentioned that this is regarding the Toledo water crisis, Toledo water situation. Mm-hmm. As you, I'm sure, are aware that EPA just this week authorized $12 million under Great Lakes Restoration Initiative to provide relief to try to address the source problem, like you said. My question is, what is going to be done differently that hasn't been done in terms of agricultural practices? How will that money be used? And do you see $12 million as the cost to fix the problem, or just $12 million as the first step?
Okay, well, and I can't really answer that in detail here in our limited time, but you can go to the Great Lakes website page, and it'll have the details on there. The money that EPA released was... end-of-year funds that were unobligated, and that they're actually going to specific projects that the states have been doing, like the fertilizer permitting stuff that Ohio's doing, and things like that, where there wasn't enough money to continue things for another year. And so it's going to fund a lot of continuing projects. There are some new projects. But I wouldn't say that they're a... I mean, it's not like a fix. It's... more source prevention. In addition, you know, Toledo has some upgrades they need to do to their drinking water treatment plant, and we're working on those as well.
Here
you go.
Hi. Randy Schofield, Trout Unlimited. I was just wondering, it does seem like, what is the status of dialogue with ag groups and others? I know you've been reaching out to them. I know that seems to be the biggest conflict with this. It does seem like they have very specific, in some cases, questions about, like, the interpretive rule as opposed to the jurisdictional rule. Could you say something about that? Because things like, and our group is a little concerned because some of the programs, projects we do with landowners involve NRCS. There are like 56 exempt conservation practices under the interpretive rule. And for instance, as you know, there's concern that ones not specifically covered could be jurisdictional. Mm-hmm. So could you talk about some of those specific
yes.
interpretive rule conflicts
sure.
and how they might be resolved?
Well, let me answer the first part of your question, too. So we continue to do very detailed outreach with the agricultural community. The administrator herself is doing it. We're all doing it. And what we're trying to do now is there's certain specific commodity groups like the pork producers, the corn producers, et cetera, and they're coming in. We've asked them to come in to offer constructive suggestions, not just say we don't like something, but why don't you like it and what's your suggestion for making it better. So there are a lot of groups. The National Farmers Union has been coming in and talking to us. So there have been some very constructive dialogues. The interpretive rule is... First of all, it's not a rule. It's a rule like that goes through the APA process. It's more like guidance, but put out in an official capacity. So it's just that's what they call it, is a rule. So basically what it is, it's saying that the Corps and EPA interpret normal farming to also include the following 56 conservation practices that may impact the waters of the U.S., but overall result in improved water quality. So it's just adding those on to normal farming because they're really not normal. I mean, they're not like plowing and seeding. They're, you know, stream fencing and things that maybe now farmers think they're normal farming, and that's been a problem. You know, in the outreach on that. This interpretive rule was done with USDA and at the request of USDA. So, and we're now working with USDA to try to figure out, you know, what we can do with the interpretive rule, because the interpretive rule was not interpreted well by the public. It did not put NRCS as a enforcement. It just said they should be done according to NRCS standards because that's what USDA said. And also, a lot of the practices that are not listed have no impact to water quality. They're upland practices. So we didn't put them in there because who would even think that they would be a problem because they don't involve putting dredge or fill in the waters of the U.S. So... stay tuned on that. There'll be a lot of clarification on that. We're working on it.
Clarifying the clarification.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's much clearer then. Thank you. All right. This is the end of our session. I wish you would please give Ellen a round of applause.